Good evening, y'all, and thank you for joining April 2023's Dante's Old South. I am your host, Clifford Brooks, and this month I bring you a little bit of the best from several genres. We have a poet, a novelist, and all the music sewn in by Alicia Blue. I want to thank Michael Amade for keeping this mad train on the tracks. I also want to thank the Red Phone Booth for the love they've shown us over the years. If you're ever in Roanoke, Virginia, please think about staying at the Liberty Trust Hotel. Last but not least, I want to thank WUTC and NPR as well as Richard Winham, who opened the door for me to have this mad show in front of you. Now, let's kick this party off on the right foot by dancing to Young by Alicia Blue.
Everybody tells you don't grow old. I'm so tired of feeling young and all alone. Goodbye, green, I'm coming for the crazy scenes. My baby's got wings. The child inside of me is waking up. She quit drinking all the milk from the same old cup. Thought I was coming to the dark side, but my baby's feeling fine.
Just coming, I don't wanna stay. Ooh.
And now on Dante's Old South, I have the honor of presenting to you, poet, professor, and personal favorite, Edgar Kunz. Edgar, how are you doing?
Good, man. How are you?
Happy I am fine and dandy like sour candy balls. I want to plug the bookstore where I found you in Athens, Georgia. Avid Books. I was in there Christmas, and they had your book faced out. One of the aspects of your book that got me to actually the aspect that made me take it off the shelf was its arresting cover. It's one of a kind, and it really shows a part of poetry that you don't hear about a lot. And this that sometimes poetry is as gritty as punk rock, man. How did that cover come to be?
Well, thanks, man. It is a pretty intense cover. They've got a designer over there at Mariner who's really incredible, Mark Robinson, and he sent us a couple ideas for the cover. And it was clear right away that this image was going to be the right one. You know, we all kind of agreed like that's one an incredible image. And you know, this is on the radio, so I guess I should describe it. It's a close up of two hands, and they're very very obviously like a working person's hands. They're covered in oil, and when you look a little closer, actually, they're very beautiful in their texture and in the color, the sheen of the oil and so on. And so, you know, originally the font was pretty intense. It was like if you can imagine a person taking a key and scratching in some paint, right? Like tap out Edgar Kunz at the bottom. And I kind of felt like, man, I don't think the poems are going to live up to a cover like that. I don't know if people are going to end up feeling a little confused about why the cover is so aggressive. And so we sort of negotiated to have much more subtle typography. We have this sans serif font. The lettering's quite small. It's sort of tucked into the middle of the hands. We don't talk a lot about this kind of stuff, but I had asked a friend for advice before signing the book contract. And this friend very astutely was like, you should try to get as much creative control over the cover as possible. And it just had that. I never thought of that, right? I thought like they just give you a cover and you deal with it, you know, which is the case, in plenty of cases. But anyway, they meaningfully consulted with me about the cover, which is the language in the contract, and we negotiated for this smaller, subtler typography, which I think if they had gone with the key and paint, you know, like it's Undertaker's autobiography or whatever. It would have made the hands feel too one-dimensional. The hands would have seemed aggressive, right? They would have seemed capable of violence, and that's all they would have been. And with this more subtle typography, the hands are more ambiguous. You know, they might be violent, but they also are tired. You know, maybe they have a capacity for tenderness. Maybe they're kind of defeated, and there's that tension. I think is really important to the cover being a good fit for the poems themselves.
When I read your work, there's a sparseness to it that makes it elegant, but like the cover, the working man's poetry to a very real extent, with the way you talk about your friends, and that we all have friends that have some chemical abuse problems, and the love that's in the tension that you have with them, the love you have for them, you know, and there's a song by Stevie Ray Vaughan, is Life by the Drop, that's talking about alcoholism, and it echoed with me that you not having that, but dealing with that with your friends, there's a delicacy that you have that I've never read anywhere else, because typically it's written as this detrimental, horrible, death-ending thing, and it you write with it like the cover. It has a greeniness to it, but also a tenderness and wanting them to be better. But you can't fix them. You know it. How do you make that balance happen?
Yeah, that tenderness is really important to me. When I first started writing these poems, I sort of settled for description. You know, I was just trying to get those characters down on the page, get some dynamics down on the page, right? Try to make that period of my life come alive in language. And then it was only later that I started feeling like, man, I'm giving everyone a pretty hard time here, and I'm giving myself a pretty hard time. And I don't know that, like, more specifically, I felt like I wasn't telling the whole story, right? It felt one dimensional, right? And it felt like I was playing into this idea of what I thought people would want to hear about how I grew up, right? And the people I grew up with and so on. And I started feeling like I was being dishonest. And so I don't think it's a coincidence that the further into writing the book I got, I was also getting, you know, in time farther away from my childhood. And so it's that distance that was allowing more tenderness to come in. You know what I mean? It was both a dissatisfaction with how I was telling this sort of story or sketching these characters. But it was also that enough time had passed that I could feel more complexly about these people that at the time seemed pretty simple to me, you know? Like my dad, I was convinced I hated my dad, right? These kids that I grew up with, it was just sad what had happened to them. And that's all it was. And that's just not the whole truth, right? And it took me a long time to realize that. And it took me a long time to get that into the poems too. So I appreciate the comment. And I mean, I think it's really important to strike a balance, like you say on the cover, right? Between the different elements, to try to get a sort of whole portrait of a full human or a full set of dynamics.
To create that, I love the question almost, and there is a mathematics to the creation of what we do. The blend of natural talent, practice, love the art, and then the technical study of it in academia, which I don't think is a bad word and people typically do. I think that there has to be the love and all that whimsy and inspiration kind of like anything else fine-tuned to directly speak in a real way. What balance do you feel there is between natural talent and working at home and then getting into the classroom and sharing that with others and learning the mechanics of it?
Yeah, I love that question. I think it's probably a function of the way I grew up. You know, my dad was a chimney sweep and a carpenter, a handyman, and, you know, his siblings all, for the most part, worked with their hands. My grandparents, my grandma and my grandfather had a wood shop together. That was like what they did for work. They sort of had a wood shop in their backyard and they sold toy boxes and rocking horses and stuff that they had made together themselves. So I definitely have internalized a sense of what it is to do work, right? Mm-hmm. And the sort of dailiness of it, the dedication required, the discipline required, and that over time, you just get better. You get better, you get faster, you get a greater sense of what you can accomplish with the tools that you have, right? And so, you know, I'm tempted to think about poetry in a really practical way like that, right? Like you show up, you do the work, you're stubborn about it, you're dedicated to trying to do the work a little better every day. And hopefully in the end, you write some stuff that means something to you and that means something to other people. You know, talent is also real. I mean, I think, you know, there are geniuses, absolutely, who maybe don't have to work as hard as the rest of us, or that work just looks different for them or something. But I'm not one of those people, you know. I've worked really hard, and I think I've gotten better over time.
Now, the hard work hasn't just been in poetry. I mean, you wanted to be a songwriter originally and actually lived in Nashville, man. Tell us about those years.
Yeah, I did. So how I got into poetry was really through a sort of side door. I went to community college out of high school. I didn't have very good grades, and you know, no one in my family really expected me to go to college if I didn't want to. And so, you know, I probably surprised some people by going to community college and taking some courses that I just thought were interesting. And one of them was a poetry class, because I felt like maybe a poetry class would help me write better songs. You know, I had a sort of dream of being a singer-songwriter. You know, I don't think I had really thought about it past, like, it'd be cool to, like, write some songs and sing at a coffee shop. You know what I mean? Yeah. A pretty humble dream. And I had been doing some of that stuff. You know, I'd written some songs. My buddy had a sort of makeshift recording studio in his basement, and we recorded some of them. And I've been in bands for a long time. You know, I was a really serious trumpet player, actually. And so I came up, you know, playing in jazz bands and jazz combos, and then I switched to ska and punk, and eventually was in a hip hop band for a while, playing trumpet in the background. In any case, man, yeah, music is really where I started. And then I got to this poetry class, and it was mind blowing. I mean, just totally knocked my socks off what I was seeing people do on the page, not just, you know, professional poets, people with books, but like my classmates. And I felt, it got its claws into me. And, you know, for a while I was kind of doing both. And then at some point, I think I realized that I just had more to offer in poetry than I did in songwriting. And you got to be realistic with yourself and say, you know, like, where are my skills actually, right? And where can I get to the level that I would want to get to? And for me, it was, it was writing poems. So that's what's lasted, really.
So you shifted into poetry from the idea of songwriting. How does music still play into your creative process?
Yeah, well, I should answer a part of your question that you asked before too, which is like how I ended up in Nashville.
Yeah.
It wasn't for songwriting reasons. I wish I could say it was, but I just went to grad school there. I did an MFA program there. And a funny part of that is, you know, people ask you, when you're in the grad program, you know, and you're trying to write your poems, trying to write your book, they say, well, what do you do? And my answer was always, well, I'm a writer. And inevitably, because we're in Nashville, they'd be like, oh, cool. Like, have I heard your stuff? You know, have you been on the radio recently? Like, what of yours can I check out? And I'd have to kind of confess to them, like, well, I don't do that kind of writing, so on. I do this thing that like no one really reads. But anyway, man, yeah, living in Nashville was a trip. It was a trip. But to your next question, man, yeah, I still play the guitar a fair amount. I taught myself how to play the guitar. And like when I'm stuck on a problem on the page, I'm pretty distractible too. So, you know, I'll be working and working, and then I'll kind of feel like, maybe I should get up and walk around, go out in the yard, come back, try to learn something on the guitar. Get tired of that, come back to the page, you know, and keep writing. I don't know. There's a lot in common between trying to like figure out a problem on the guitar and figure out a problem on the page. In the sense that like I'll be trying to learn how to play a series of chords smoothly on the guitar, and I'll be sort of trying like learning a new finger picking pattern or something like that, right? And I'll not be really getting it right, and I'll go to sleep. And I'll wake up the next day and I'll pick up the guitar and I can play it perfectly. Our brains are wild, man. I mean, that's crazy. Our brains are just churning in the background no matter what else we're doing. And so I feel like that's often how poetry's working on me too. I set something in motion on the page and then I go do other stuff. And then I come back and my brain has kind of figured out a way to move forward in the poem or solve some little problem that I was dealing with.
And with the fervor that you give our audience about the practical knowledge of poetry and the passion that you bring to it, and then balance that out, I want folks to hear how you do it on the page. Would you mind reading us a poem from Tap Out?
Yeah, I'd love to. This poem is called Salvage. I realized at some point writing this book that I had written a lot about my father. And I really, you know, I only mentioned my mom in places sort of here and there. And I figured I should write a poem that sort of gives her her due. So this is a poem for her. It's called Salvage. Still somewhere in me, the summer spent driving steel into the wet earth, heft and swing of the mattock, my blistered hands, black flies rising like steam. The tables I served, the law firms I hustled from one zip line to another, classroom where I taught economics to the medicated kids of bus drivers and stevedores, swept clean boulevards of the city that paid me to snap a picture of every downtown business, jot the names and hours in a spiral-bound book. Somewhere in me, the failed industrial towns of New England with their posh English names, Weymouth, Bridgeport, Lowell, Worcester, their dead cars, their factories and silk mills converted and upsold to commuters. Somewhere, the third-floor walk-up we lived in longest, cracked plaster,
and single pane, plastic paneling painted to look like real wood, and my stepmother, my real mom, bending over the glossy stack of Star Market mailers, hands thin, approximate, bright scars on the backs of her wrists where the surgeries didn't take. And me, problem kid with a mushroom cut and his shirt tucked into his sweats, clipping the dollar offs, the half offs, the buy one get ones, the buy one get twos, the store issued doublers, shoulder to shoulder on the kitchen floor, and the afternoon stretching on into no kind of heaven I could have understood then. Of peeling linoleum and the drone of interstate traffic. Of WIC checks, name brand knockoffs, the gray stamps card made to pass as a regular visa. Where we are allowed to know exactly what we can have and keep and what it will cost.
It makes you stop. And it that sounds trite, but it's rare. And I don't want your humility to try to stand up and say it's not. I ain't gonna let this happen on this show. The way that you approach this topic is what we said earlier, is that you tell the truth, but you don't bring in a pain that pushes the author away from it. I mean, how do you do that?
Well, I don't really know. I mean, I try to bring in as much detail as I can, you know, from memory. I try to get across this sort of tenderness between me and my mother, sort of weird tenderness that we found to be together. To be honest, this poem, now that I'm reading it this time, reminds me of this Seamus Heaney poem, and it's part of a sequence of sonnets that he wrote. And the one section I'm thinking about is about his mom, and the first line is, "While all the others were away at mass." Do you know that poem?
It's where he
and his mom are peeling potatoes.
Yeah,
right? Yeah, and it's this, you know, it's this sort of retrospective poem, or the turn of the poem is retrospective, where he says something like, you know, while the parish priest went hammer and tongs at the prayer for the dying, and some were responding and some were crying, and he says, like, I think back to that time, you know, her breath and mine are fluent dipping knives, never closer the whole rest of our lives. And it just made me think, like, right, those strange intimacies that we find, that come back to us, you know, out of memory, that sort of float up to us and beg to be examined. So this is one of those weird, like, we're cutting coupons because we were too broke to afford groceries. Right. You know what I mean? And we were crazy about it. I mean, I'd spend hours and hours cutting coupons and going with my mom to the grocery store and making sure we got the right brands and the right amounts and so on. And this poem is just kind of trying to get back to, you know, because as a kid, you hate it. God, I hated it so much.
Right.
It didn't strike me as like, you know, this is valuable time I'm spending with my mom. It felt like, oh God, this is an awful chore that I have to do all the time. But in retrospect, right, you realize like those were some important hours that we spent together. You know, that's what closeness is. In a very real way, that's what love was between us.
When you look at Tap Out, and then you look at your new book, Fixer, how does Fixer grow from Tap Out?
Yeah, Fixer, I kind of think of them as a duo, right? Like, I think Fixer is very much a sort of continuation and complication of the themes of Tap Out. But the poems are a more accurate reflection of my life the past 10 years. You know, Tap Out is really pretty intensely about my childhood and about my really early adulthood. And then Fixer moves into the sort of territory that I'm in now, which is, you know, I'm in my mid-30s. I've moved around a lot. I've had a lot of weird jobs. I've finally settled into a job that I like. I teach now, which is really such a gift. I'm in love. We have a garden, you know? I think Tap Out ended up feeling like I was working for a long time in a kind of small dark room where I knew my subjects and I more or less knew what I all the parts that I wanted to touch on and all the characters I wanted to introduce and so on. And I started to get a sense of like, okay, here's the trajectory of it, you know? but I felt very much locked into those themes. And so there wasn't a lot of room for sort of exploration, letting air and light into the room, because I thought that's what was required to make the book work. And that may or may not be true. I don't know. But the second book is much, much airier, much, much more spacious. I bring in a lot of weird stuff, you know, the impending robot revolution, tech jobs, Bitcoin, love poems. I mean, everything is sort of like coming together in a confluence in these poems. And I just kind of let that happen. There was a teacher I had who said, you know, your hands are really tight on the wheel. What would happen if you loosened your grip a little bit? And so I tried to follow that advice in this book. And I think the result is that the poems are much more various. You know, they take on a lot of different subjects. They're also more rangy emotionally and tonally, right? The poems are kind of funny. I mean, I like to think of a pretty funny person in real life, and you read Tap Out, and it's like, God, this guy's serious, huh? This guy doesn't have much of a sense of humor. And in Fixer, I think it's a better, I guess, a more accurate reflection of who I am as a person, who I've grown to be as a person. And that's really satisfying.
Well, that begs me now to ask you if we could have a poem from Fixer.
Yeah, I'd love to read one. This is a poem called Night Heron. I used to live in Oakland, California, and there's a lake just off downtown called Lake Merritt. And it's a kind of bird sanctuary, right? There are pelicans and cormorants and stuff. And there are these little birds that go kind of under song, and they're called night herons. And they are herons. I mean, technically they are herons, but they're these little tiny kind of squat birds that look like they're like up to something. They're up to no good, you know? And that's why I really fell in love with them. So I was like, wow, what a name. And then the reality is like, they're just this little kind of sneaky looking creature. And so they make an appearance in this poem, despite the title. This poem is also all one sentence. I mean, it's almost all one sentence. So I'm going to read it accordingly in a kind of like headlong way. Night Heron. What now? You'd flown in from a Midwest city named for its rowdy summertime abundance, lying, saying you were coming to visit friends in San Francisco, and I had taken the train from chilly Oakland to meet you, and we rode north, carefully not touching. I took you to the tiny one-room apartment I had escaped to after the divorce and fried us nervously some potatoes in a cast iron pan, a little rosemary, which we did not eat because you kissed me hard. And we went in a rush to the mattress I bought off a guy in a semi-famous band and had only the day before gotten off the floor and onto the pinewood bed frame I'd found and hoisted on my back and carried down out of North Berkeley, arms wide, weaving through the side streets, towing the center line to avoid snagging the Buckeyes leaning out. It was about suffering in public. It was dramatic, sure, but the dramas of my life those days were pitched as high as I could stand, higher sometimes. I said, breathless, I want to taste you. And you said, please, yes. And later, out at the edge of the lake, huddled against the damp wind, hot grease soaking through a paper bag, licking salt from each other's fingers obscenely, a night heron peered up at us from the reeds, small, hunched, dipping its shining beak in the shallows, not particularly beautiful, but a heron nevertheless, the same one we were sure we saw perched on the awning outside the theater whose marquee shouted slogans like, we live in a fake democracy, and prevent unwanted presidencies with hand-counted paper ballots. And later, the cabin we rented with friends in Calaveras, snowmelt, vaulting the redwoods to magnificent heights, drinking rye, and each of us practicing our best wolf howl at the waning moon, which was ridiculous, yes. But once we started, it became impossible to stop. Waking up next morning, hoarse and happy, and you moved west. And we lived together in a studio overlooking the cafe dumpster, and then back east on a dream of a house and a garden, and then my father died. And at almost the same age yours did, and both from drink and an unnameable sadness. I went back to Connecticut alone. 3.5 days, my mother said, before anyone had found him in his apartment on the far side of town, and going with my brother, which we should not have done, and dragging the mattress out, and clearing the maggots off the ceiling, the shop back, and so on. And later,
you came. And we walked through the basement of my mother's house. I wanted to show you where for a while he lived and how. And you slung your arm around my waist and we moved slowly together, bare fluorescent bulb shining on the Budweiser ashtray, the carpentry tools I would inherit, the ratty couch he crashed on for years. You held up an old Calypso record he loved and sang out softly, jump in the lime, rock your body in time. And I sang back softly, okay, I believe you. And after a while, Mom at the top of the stairs shouting, what are you kids doing down there? And climbing the steps, you pinch my elbow and ask if I'm okay. And I hear myself say, yes, which is not a lie, though I'm not listening. I'm letting myself feel how astonishing what our love can make of a place like that.
There is no accident in how fluid your emotion arrests the reader. The idea of it being one sentence, but then you read it in a way that isn't rushed.
There.
That's not an accident. It begs me to ask you, when you sit down and write and come back to edit, how does the editing process flesh out your real meaning?
Yeah, all the magic happens in revision. All the magic happens in revision. My first drafts are a mess. My first drafts are just like sloppy and you know, sometimes every once in a while, you know, you feel like you've been struck by lightning and a poem comes out and you think, yeah, that's probably just about done. And even that poem, you make some changes to over time. But I find that I don't even know what I'm writing about until I get to the second, third, fourth draft of a poem. And I've got all these methods to try to see the poem in a fresh way. So I don't want to get too committed to what a poem looks like or what I think the poem is about in the early stages. I think it's good to sort of keep an open mind and keep your eye out for other possibilities, other ways the poem might turn or something might enter it and change things. And one of those methods is I record every poem or every draft of a poem into my phone. It's like one of the amazing things about having a phone that's capable of doing that. And I play it back to myself while I mentioned before, you know, I like to go and do other stuff while I'm writing because it helps me solve problems. And this is one way that allows me to kind of estrange myself from the poem. You know, I'll put it on in my headphones and just play it over and over again while I'm washing the dishes or cooking dinner or whatever, you know, vacuuming or just doing some household chores. And I find that doing that makes it clear to me eventually what parts of the poem are corny, what parts of the poem I'm like trying too hard to make something happen, what parts of the poem are kind of clunky in the way that they sound and they should be revisited. And also, honestly, it's helpful to go back to a poem after you've had a drink or two, you know, at first thing in the morning, maybe you're like your consciousness is a little stranger. I mean, anything you can do to kind of come to the page as like a slightly different person, that's all really helpful to being able to encounter the poem, you know, in a new way and maybe dream up some new possibilities for you know, how to proceed.
So looking at it with a broad lens, what are the principal differences between Tap Out and your new book?
Yeah. I think it's just a really short book. And it's sort of like, I think it's Eamon Grennan who has this poem about, it's an Ars Poetica media, so it's a poem about, you know, writing a poem. And it's a sort of lyric meditation on a bird being snatched up and carried off by a larger bird. And I feel like this book kind of happened to me in that way. This book is like an eagle that came down and snatched a little like mouse me up in its talons and carried me up. I don't know, man. I mean, I was staying at I hadn't been writing, you know, for years, really. I had been writing really intermittently and it felt like I didn't really have anything to say. I hadn't lived enough new life to have, you know, some new things to say about what was going on with me. And we were staying, me and my sweetheart were staying at a friend's house in upstate Vermont. And,
you know, we had the wood stove going. We were like 5 miles down a dirt road, you know, no one, we were basically uncontactable. And these poems just started to come out, you know, they were coming out in couplets and 18 lines. And I felt like, oh, that's a nice shape. Maybe I'll try to, you know, write a bunch of these. And pretty soon I had, you know, 13, 14 of them. And they were all centered around the same subject, you know, and it became the middle section of the book. They're all poems about me and my brothers in the aftermath of my dad dying. And my brothers are 10 and 11 years younger than me. So it's an interesting dynamic where, you know, generationally we're a little bit separated, but we're also joined by shared experience, you know, at least in some shared experience from how we grew up. And so once I had those poems kind of going, I felt like I had been given, a set of subjects and maybe a shape that I could build poems around. And so that all happened very quickly. I mean, the book came together. I had an odd poem here and there, but I wrote that middle section, and then the middle section suggested other poems. And then, you know, I kid you not, this was in January, and by March or April, I had a book. And I just sent it to my editor, and she was like, "This is a book." And I was like, "Great, do you want to publish it?" And she said, "Let me talk to the other editor." And then she said, "Yes," you know, and now it's coming out in August. So yeah, it's a book. I feel that this book happened to me, but I had to do a lot of waiting around and remaining receptive to the idea that maybe, you know, some poems would happen. I kept coming to the writing desk and not much was happening. And then finally I had a big breakthrough, and contrasting that with Tap Out, I wrote for like 10 years, you know, I mean, it was just the first book. It often tells the tale of the writer up to that point. And that's very much the case with my book. You know, so the oldest poems in this book I wrote at the very beginning of grad school, you know, like, yeah, like early days of taking myself seriously as a poet. And then Fixer, the earliest poem, is from like 2021, mm-hmm. You know? So it's just a much shorter time scale. I don't know, time will tell if that changes how the books read compared to one another, or you know, how things end up working out. But it's cool that like I was surprised by the second book happening. I kind of thought it would be a 10-year slog like the first one.
All right.
Yeah.
You go through this interview with priceless pieces of information that aren't obvious, that aren't often taught, because I think in a big way they can't be. So to come back to the nuts and bolts of the writing process, what practical advice do you have to those who want to make poetry a vocation?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a couple ideas off the top of my head. One of them is, I think it's important that you make one friend. You really just need one friend who cares about poetry as much as you do and is willing to go on this journey with you, you know, alongside you. They'll tell you when a poem is working or not working. You know, someone you can trust, really. Yes. Someone who has, you know, taste that's close enough to yours, you know, an aesthetic that's close enough to yours. That you can feel like, okay, we're kind of writing alongside each other. Another piece of advice is I think you should write fan mail. I think you should reach out to poets that you love. Believe it or not, poets don't get a lot of letters. You know what I mean? Even huge poets, you know? You write to Natasha Trethewey and it may be the only letter she gets that month from a fan, you know, even though she's like a giant in literature. So I think it's important to sort of strike up correspondence with your heroes. You know, they might have some good advice for you. They might be able to tell you something about how they put their poems together. But also it starts to form a little community around you. And suddenly this really lonely art form that you are participating in becomes a part of a larger web. You know, you're making it feel like a communal thing rather than a sort of crushingly, as it can feel sometimes, crushingly solitary thing. Yeah. So don't be bashful about writing to people whose work you admire.
Well, as we round this down, and as you mentioned that, tell us how we can find you online and how up-and-comers can reach out to you.
Write me some fan mail. Somebody write me something. I mean, I'm just joking, but really, you know, happy to talk. You can find me online. I have a website. It's edgarkunz.com. You can find me on Twitter at Edgar James Kunz, on Instagram at Lock the Cash Box. You can find my school email address if you want to email me through there. That'd be cool too.
And your school, who puts your genius to work?
Yeah, well, who's foolish enough to let me go into the classroom a couple of times a week and say some stuff? I'm at Goucher College. It's in Baltimore, Maryland, which is where I live now. And it's a lovely little school with a really strong creative writing program.
Edgar, it has been a divine pleasure to have you on the show. We've been going back and forth for about 3 years, man, and it is absolutely worth the wait. And what I want you to understand on a biblical level is that as you have things that come up and wisdom that you want to share, I need you to call me so we can have you back on the show.
I'd love to come back. No, likewise. I mean, what an absolute pleasure. I'm really grateful to you, Clifford.
Slowly, I'm callous, but I feel good. I'm soft on the inside, 'cause nothing feels the way it looks. I hate interruptions. I caught a few in my youth. I'm kind of defensive, like a non-believer with a clue. When it's unknown that it pops up, when I'm trying to grow my heart shuts, this pain I call friend. Make me a believer too. I'm weak when it's easy. I'm braver when I'm knocked down. People don't bother me, but I hate sitting in a crowd. Is something got some from my daddy's side. Hate climbing if it's not for the mystery living inside. Oh, see me, babe, the way I see you. Make me a believer too. It's when it's unknown up, when I'm trying to grow my heart shuts, this pain I call friend. Make me a believer too. I know that everything will be alright. I know that everything is right on time. See me, babe, the way I see you. Make me a believer too. It's when it's unknown that it pops up, when I'm trying to grow my heart shuts, this pain I call friend. Up when I'm trying to grow my heart shuts, this pain I call friend. Make me a believer too.
And now, on Dante's Old South, we have author, professor, and master of the weird, Gregory Ariel. Gregory, how are you doing?
Very good. How about you? Thanks for having me.
I mean,
that's a lot to live up to, master of the weird. I think perhaps the apprentice of the weird would be better right now.
Well, when people read your novel, The Gospel of Rot, whose title by itself demands your attention, they'll see what I see. They'll see what I see. But before we get into that, man, tell us about how you began. I mean, what got you into words and what drew you into the weird?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a long story. I think, you know, the first thing that happened in my life that was really big, actually really got me into literature and got me into art, was in high school. I took a film class, and me and a couple friends decided to do an adaptation of The Hobbit. And so we rented these horses and we went up to the North Carolina mountains, the kind of Highlands Cachers region of North Carolina. I don't know if you've ever been, but it's absolutely beautiful. And yeah, we spent a few weeks filming this adaptation of The Hobbit. And I think ever since then, I associated the North Carolina mountains and Southern Appalachia with fantasy and strange things. And so I think that's definitely one origin point of it. But also, I grew up hiking in that area, you know, just about every other weekend. And I think that's, yeah.
All right. It's now the book deep dives into lore on multiple levels, and you hem it together seamlessly. I'm not going to give away the plot, and I won't let you either, obviously. But tell us about this novel, starting with how you created the unique title, The Gospel of Rot.
So, you know, I think part of it is that, I mean, actually, you know, I came up with the title kind of randomly in the car at some point. But I think, you know, the book deals a lot with kind of rotten things, forgotten things, you know, things forgotten in Southern history. I was really interested in kind of a few very obscure Appalachian folk photographers. I did a lot of research at actually Western Carolina University on Appalachian folk photography. And one person I found, Reinfried Romanus, who was a German immigrant to Southern Appalachia, he had like 20 or 30 boxes of these amazing photographs. And he was actually the inspiration for my protagonist's father. And so definitely Appalachian kind of folk photography is one of the origin points for this book. And also, you know, in terms of the gospel part, I'm an agnostic, but I was raised Christian, but kind of off and on. I feel like Christianity came to me in fragments. And so I think, you know, part of this book is exploring the theme of a kind of a Christianity in fragments.
So the protagonist, you take brave strides in this book, mentioning with the father. Tell us how the protagonist came to be and the direction you took her to the extent you want to share with us.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to find the moment when I discovered Amelia exactly. I wrote a fantasy novel whose protagonist was named Amelia. And I think that was, it was a disaster. It didn't work out. And so I think I really liked the name. I tried to write high fantasy for a couple of years. It just didn't work out. I feel like I need to be in a historical space for whatever reason. But I think Amelia and I have a lot in common. You know, we're both, you know, I'm not quite as reclusive as her. You know, she was a recluse for 50 years in my book, but I'm quite reclusive. She's a lover of Appalachian landscape. She's also a lover of literature and romantic literature. I think I just wanted the challenge of writing somebody who's also very different from me. She's a 70-year-old woman where when we start with her in the novel, and that just provided a real kind of exciting challenge, I think.
It's the book, you know, it comes at you sideways. And what I mean by that is that you're never taken off guard, but you're always looking around the corner for what's coming with an excitement, almost like Christmas morning, more than like, all right, where's the boogeyman? You never feel off. You never feel quite in place, but you always find some comfortable spot to sit down. One of those was the use and interjection of Sir Walter Scott, man. Tell me how you came to that decision.
Yeah, so I did a master's in romantic literature at Oxford University in the UK. So I have a great love for romantic and Victorian lit. But, you know, Sir Walter Scott is an interesting character because, you know, during the time Amelia would, you know, in the 1920s when she would have been a young woman, Sir Walter Scott was one of the, you know, most beloved writers in the South. And now he's become one of those kind of moribund things, a kind of a defunct writer that nobody reads anymore. I mean, even at university, I teach at the University of Alabama, and, you know, I don't think he's really taught anymore. So I was interested in Sir Walter Scott as this kind of lost writer, this forgotten writer, but who was really loved in the South. And, you know, a lot of writers that I admire, Virginia Woolf in particular, had great admiration for Sir Walter Scott. And so, yeah, for me, I think also at the time that I was starting this book late in 2019, so this is definitely my pandemic novel,
right?
Which might, you know, be part of why it's such a weird, wacky book. But I was just kind of returning to some of the romantic writers I wasn't super familiar with, and so Walter Scott was one of them. And also, I found out kind of early on when I was writing the book that geologically, the Appalachian Mountains and the Scottish Highlands were once a single mountain chain. And so there was this kind of secret connection between, you know, southern, you know, my southern Appalachia and the Scottish Highland. And so I thought that was kind of cool. And at one point, he kind of journeys under the ocean. I don't want to reveal too much, but he journeys under the ocean from Scotland to North Carolina. And that kind of geological history was part of that, the kind of the backstory for me. Especially.
All right. I got to dig a little deeper into how have you brought British romantic literature into the South and tweaked it on your own?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that was one of the really fun things about the project too, is I have one chapter that's largely from the perspective of Walter Scott, who's giving a kind of a long speech. And so one of my projects was imitating his style, his literary style. So I wasn't so much imitating how a Scottish person would have spoken on the street in, you know, the early 19th century, but I read his novels, and I just tried to absorb his voice and his diction. And so yeah, I mean, that was a great challenge, but also a joy in writing the book. And so whenever he and Amelia have a conversation, I try to bring in some of that kind of archaic language, and hopefully a little flair.
Definitely. It's definitely there. And to talk about how you wrote the novel, to wrap it up, get towards the end of this beautiful moment, I want to know the technical side of things, and that, what writing habits do you have? Do you have to be in a certain place? Do you have to be in a certain mindset? Does the muse come to you often, or do you have to go find her? How does it work in your world?
Yeah, you know, it's changed a lot over time. When I first started writing in college, it was very intermittent. I had a lot of trouble developing a consistent practice. And I would just do it here and there. And I was also not the healthiest person psychologically for quite a while during my collegiate years, my early collegiate years. And so writing really became a more consistent practice for me after my PhD program. And then actually when I jumped to an MFA in, I guess it was 5 years ago now, that the MFA actually gave me time and space to finally start writing. And I think in that case, I was finally able to begin a pretty consistent daily, near daily practice of just, you know, writing a little bit, you know, even if it's just 150 or 200 words a day. And I've maintained that now for the last few years. And I think that it's just part of my daily routine, kind of how I stay healthy and relatively happy. It's just the consistency of that practice, which I never really had early in my life.
Well, Gregory Arion, it has been fantastic to have you on this show, and it has been a weird journey to enjoy the Gospel of Rot, man. Tell us how we can find you and your book online.
So you can find my book at pretty much any of the major sellers. So you can find me, you know, on Barnes & Noble or Amazon, or bookshop.org is a great one. And you can also find links to all of my stories and essays and hopefully my upcoming novels on gregoryariel.com. I'm also on Instagram at gariel. Not the biggest Twitter user, but maybe one day I will transition to that. But yeah, so yeah, I mean, Cliff, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And Gregory, this has been a really cool thing to do on a beautiful Saturday afternoon, man. And as time goes on, we're going to have you in the Blue Mountain Review soon. And anytime you've got anything you want to tell NPR, man, you give me a holler.
Will do.
God bless y'all for hanging in here with me for the last hour for April 2023's Dante's Old South. Let me thank once again NPR, WUTC, our brilliant guests, producer Michael Amade and Magic Man Richard Weller. Y'all be good to one another, and good night.